And while we are actually downloading this data and processing this data sets, and we are looking into these non-diseased microbiome across different geographies, we noticed that although there were some groups, known groups like Bacteroides or Akkermansia, which were like increased with the industrialization, there were other bacteria like the vanished taxa, like the Prevotella, the Cacnibacterium, Phosphilacta, which actually decreased group industrialization. But there was a certain group of taxa that seemed to be more or less up with similar prevalence across non-diseased individuals from these countries.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest, we're delighted to have Tarini Ghosh from Hyderabad in India. And Tarini is what I would call maybe a computational biologist, or kind of a slang word is a bioinformatician. Would you agree with that characterization, Tarini? And could you explain to our listeners maybe what a computational biologist does?
So basically, I would like to call myself a computational microbiologist or a microbiome data scientist, just to make it fancy. But basically, what I do is my interest primarily revolves around performing data-driven investigations of the human microbiome. Basically, we struggles like development of algorithms as well as performing large-scale analysis of global microbiome data to identify patterns. These patterns that can be used for to generate hypotheses that can be further tested in vitro or ex vivo or in vivo settings like doing clinical trials or facilitating clinical microbiome research.
Just to orientate our listeners, the data you're talking about here is typically sequencing data. Is that correct?
That's correct. But we typically, we do in our lab or what I've been doing since a while back, is to collect data that can be sequencing data along with the metadata of the different samples that are available as part of global repositories. They can be sequencing data sources, or they can be collected from specific studies, or there are already like microbiome data repositories available. Like, for example, the curated metagenomic data, for example, the GM repositories, a lot of repositories coming up, which basically contain either the sequence data or the processed data from sequence data that are generated as part of other studies. So what we do is, so we collect the data from these sources, some of the data, and we have some unified pipelines, and we analyze this data using this unified pipelines. Like if we have to use whole genome sequencing data sources or data, then we have a specific pipeline that we use. If we have to use 16S cohorts, then we have another standardized pipeline that we use, and we ensure that all the data is processed using the same set of pipelines so that we don't have variability with respect to the profiles that we generate. And then what we do is we further divide the sources into like WGS subgroups, 16S subgroups, and then basically it's all an investigation of the consistency of patterns, like which patterns are introduced across different geographies, which patterns are specific to a certain geography, which are like method-associated patterns, like only we see something in WGS data and not in the 16S data, things that are also specific to the 16S data sources. And then we ask, and these analysis we perform on specific questions. Like, for example, we propose an index, and then we see how reproducible is the index. Now, that index can be also dependent on the data sources that we use. And we have to validate the index that we derive from one kind of data source and to see how much of it translates to the other kind of data source. Only then it makes sense if it's reproducible. So this is what we do. And then what we do is after we generate the profiles, we use different kinds of statistical machine learning. And to some extent, we have started applying advanced deep learning strategies to analyze these data to answer different questions.
And with these data sets, I mean, you look at, in your studies, I assume you look at hundreds or thousands of individuals, and then you look at hundreds of millions of sequences containing hundreds of base pairs from those individuals. How do these data sets compare to, you know, what we would typically hear about a big data collected in maybe deep space surveys or other things like that? Are these really big data sets?
So, for example, Colin, the data that we use to for the hack paper, like some of the many of the data sets Like we had to actually reanalyze close to 80% of the data sets up and down to Big Bang. And the data accumulated to close to around 50 or 60 TB of data, terabytes of data. So if you look at the volume, it's not as huge as like financial data, but it's still huge. Like if you are working with a typical biological data, those who have worked with it, they'll know that like 50 to 60 TB is a huge number. And at the current rate, the overall we are building this data resources. And so currently we have data from close to 300 studies. And we're just calculating the sequence data, just the volume of the sequence data. So that was close to 210 TB of data. So I would say, Colin, microbiome data has recently become or is approaching very close to being a big data resource. And that is good for people like us.
Dorini, you're using these big data sets to try to come up with very useful summaries of how the microbiome is associated with human health and also how it has resilience. Can you talk to us about the HAC index, what motivated it, and the approach you're using to develop it?
Yeah, absolutely, Dango. So basically, the idea about the question that has been propping up in my mind and in almost all, in everyone's mind who's working with the microbiome, is the variability. The main problem is we know microbiome is important. We know the microbiome definitely plays a role. It plays a role as a sensor where it can store diagnostic. It plays a role as a modulator or a transducer of the dietary effects on our health. But the problem, the basic thing is we don't know what actually constitutes or as how the microbiome is built in the first place. So round about the time I joined Powell's lab, there was a string of studies which came up. Now, there were multiple studies and they were actually examining this aspect one or the other. And they were very conflicting with respect to each other. Like there were multiple papers coming out showing how the microbiome is variable across populations, like especially the non-industrialized versus the industrialized gradient. And they were like the Vannis taxa and the Blossom taxa. People were talking about that. And there were like a lot of viewpoints, including one of our reviews that we published in Gastroenterology Journal, where we actually identify like the microbiome across different populations is very different. And in this context, we also published a study with Fergus on the Irish travelers' gut microbiome, where we also saw that the Irish travelers, who were basically lead a nomadic lifestyle, they have a very different microbiome from the settled Irish populations and had a microbiome very similar to the tribal communities like Hadjars and the Peruvians and the Mongolians. There were also some studies by us which observed that the microbe, even the disease-associated microbiome alterations, they were not similar in different subgroups or in different across different age or across different regions. Now, at the other extreme of this, were studies including like meta-analysis of like we published in Nature Aging, we identified that there were like some markers or some taxa that tended to be associated with the shared microbiome signature. Like there were several species which changed their representation, or that is, they were either enriched or depleted across multiple diseases, indicating that there might be something very special about this. Now, added to that, there were some sporadic reports which also said that, hey, there were so like some species like Akkermansia, they are typically associated with health, but like improved cardiometabolic health or associated with aging. But at the same time, there are other studies which are coming up and showing that, oh, this Akkermansia and eosinophilia is actually linked to down inflammation. So there were like sporadic reports like this. And these questions always kept dropping off even in our mind. Like, if this is the case, now this is not a very helpful situation. Now, if you have to actually build microbiome-based measures or microbiome-based endpoints for diagnosing health or for judging the efficacies of therapeutic interventions, we need to come up with some measure there that is universal, that doesn't vary across individuals. Or either they can be taxa or there can be specific functions. So then when I started my group here, as part of my background in APC, I have built up a collection of data sets, which I had to using on a regular basis. And we started to build upon that when I started my group here, because we are an IT institute, so we have a lot of access to a lot of data sources, a lot of high-end computational infrastructure. So we started downloading this data and then processing it. And while we are actually downloading this data and processing this data sets, and we're looking into these non-diseased microbiome across different geographies, we noticed that although there were some groups, known groups like Bacteroides or Akkermansia which were like increased with the industrialization. There were other bacteria like the vanished taxa, like the Prevotella, the Campylobacter, first filter, these actually decreased with industrialization. But there were a certain group of taxa that seemed to be more or less occurring with similar prevalence across non-disease individuals from these countries, across different countries. And we looked at 70 odd countries by then. Now, this was encouraging. And then we started questions, asking like if there are some members within the gut that show strong associations with the non-diseased individuals or that are generally conserved across geographies. Like there might be a subset. We cannot fully define a healthy population across different geographies, but we can actually identify a subset that is conserved in the healthy individuals. So like when I was thinking and I was trying to explain to my student, this guy, he came from a protein science background. So I just tried to explain him that, see, you have different kinds of like serine proteases, right? Chemotrypsin, elastase. So that have different kinds of serine proteases. Now they are structurally, they are very different and each structure is adapted to a certain environment based on its substrate, but based on the kind of function that it does. But all serine proteases, they have a technical track. So essentially, if you imagine the microbiome like a protease, so these conserved taxa that we are seeing over here, they might be the ones that are the key for a proper microbiome assembly. And all the other things are important. It's not that the others are not important, but there are some which are more important than the others. And then we also notice some other aspects, like let's not only look into the association with health, but let's also look into the association with like how properly a microbiome is ingrained in the community. Like, for example, there are some papers, for example, if you look at them, the recently published paper by Jens Hartus' group, the Nimedine. So what they observe is this lactobacillus reuteri. So it's a, like they give the probiotic, it is retained till some amount of time, but then it vanishes. So with also looking into that, we also tried to put in other properties, like the microbiome should be actually retained, like the particular microbes should be retained in the microbiome, so it should be connected, and it should be associated with the stability. And because we have the longitudinal data sets as well, close to 10,000, then we try to answer the question, like, can we also try to like rank the taxa not only based on the association with health, but with how close they are incorporated in the microbiome, like they are the core members or the connected members, and how strong they are associated with longitudinal stability or temporal stability in the microbiome. So we proposed three subscores, the core subscore, that is how connected it was, the health subscore, that is the health association score, how frequently it was connected with healthy individuals. So we considered around 28 different disease conditions, and these 28 different disease conditions, and we measured how frequently each micro was enriched in health in the non-disease individuals across these 28 diseases. So that was our second index. And our third index was the longitudinal stability index, like how frequently it is associated with stability across the across the time points, if you take longitudinal microbiota samples. And then you combine them. So we call this the health-associated core keystone, because core means we are looking into the core taxa, that is prevalent in the non-disease individuals. Keystone, because they were the keystone index that we computed, that is how connected they are, that means they are connected as well as they are associated with the stability of the microbiome. So that's why they are called as the keystone. And then the health association, that is the health association score. So health associated core keystone, that's the health index. So that's the bracket.
I think that's a fascinating concept and maybe does provide us a kind of a solution to the problem that you so elegantly described at the start, that variety and diversity and difference among microbiomes seems to swamp any kind of a signal of a healthy microbiome or diseased microbiome. And these health-associated core keystone species, I guess, or taxa, are they the most abundant ones in the gut, or can they even be keystones but present in very low amounts, relatively speaking, in the gut?
That's a very interesting question, Colin. So we also did an analysis of that, like the index with respect to their prevalence or their abundance. We observed a relationship with abundance. Like there were some abundant members. Mostly some of these core keystones were generally more prevalent or abundant, but there was no direct relationship. There were some taxa which were prevalent and abundant, but at the same time, they were not identified as the hacks. So generally the hacks tend to be more abundant and tend to be more prevalent, but it doesn't mean that anything that is prevalent or abundant can be classified as a hack. A typical example, I think, in that context should be the Pollinella efficiens. So it is a very prevalent taxa across the globe. So these taxa, they tend to be more, calling cellulitis to be more ingrained, more prevalent. So it's picked up as a core, but it is not picked up as a hack, primarily because its disease association are not very towards health. So that's what we found out.
Tarina, you pointed out that these indices could be based on the composition of the microbiome, or they could be based on the function. And then you developed a scheme that actually is based on the composition, based on taxa. And you're,
yeah.
So can you talk to us about how you connect the index that you come up with function? And can you also talk to us about how you imagine that function might end up being the focus of future indices as opposed to composition?
Yeah, that's another very good question, Daniel. So here we have actually, so that's one of our ongoing studies, but here also we have actually put a step in that direction in this particular study. So what we did over here was, so once we came up with indices, like we have indices for every species, we ranked based on their NAC index. Now, we did a very, a preliminary analysis, like, okay, if this is at the index, and if we look into their genomic functions, can we actually identify genomic functions of these species that correlate with these indices? So parallelly, what we were doing, again, as part of mine in the group is, so Nicolas Segueta's lab has developed a very nice collection of MAGs, that is like metagenome assembled genomes from, there are around 150,000 MAGs. And we further—
Oh, tell me what those are. I'm afraid I don't know what MAGs are.
So MAGs are like metagenome assembled genomes. So what these MAGs are is, so you have a metagenomic data set, so like a short gene sequence data set from a GARP or from any other source. So what you do is you try to assemble the genomes from within the metagenomic sequences. And then you get these different genomic assemblies that you create from the metagenomic data set. And they have built a very well curated metagenomic data set used for mapping. And this data set is very special. The thing is, because you know the source of the metagenome from it came from, you know the source metadata of those guys. And you know like from which MAG is assembled from which particular study cohort and whether that particular species is actually identified as a pore, what is this pore score in that particular study cohort. So you can go back to that way. So we are actually working on that. But here what we did was we did two kinds of analysis. We got the MAGs and we got the reference genomes. And what we did was we did a full functional annotation of these genomes. And then what we did was we had the hack source that we computed for each of these species. And for each of these species, we also did the functional profiling of all its constituent genomes. So we had close to 71,000 genomes. Now, they brought us around 33,000 MAGs plus other F6 sequences. And then what we did was, because they're computing the scores at species level, we identified the conserved functional profiles of each species based on their constituent genomic functional profiles, and they try to relate the genomic profiles, functional profiles, to their hack scores. So that was one analysis. The second analysis that we tried to do is, now there are also studies where people have, our researchers have actually found out experimentally validated metabolic functionalities for each of these species. So there are some studies which have. So for every species, they take monoculture data as well as some study-specific data, and they have built up the repositories. I have used these repositories in APC also, where we were working. Pauline University, remembering the New Age Mid-Diet study. So I had used collated these repositories of metabolic functionalities for each of these, for different species. So these are like experimentally validated functionalities at the species level. And then these two functional profiles to try to relate with the hack scores, the hack indices, using a combination of random forest-based machine learning where we selected out the features. And then we did a further statistical analysis like regression modeling to identify a core set of features associated with this hack scores, a core set of functional features.
And what are the implications of this, Tarini? Let's imagine, I'm simplifying things now way beyond you actually suggested, but if we could come up with 100 biomarkers, whether they're taxonomic or functional biomarkers, to measure, to judge a microbiome, we can then, what, do an intervention and ask the question, is this improving or disimproving a microbiome? You know, is that where we're heading for? Or you could use it more as a diagnostic tool to predict maybe a disposition towards a disease, which you could then take action to prevent? Or, you know, how do you see this act being actually utilized in clinics or in dietitians or by dietitians or by food scientists?
Yeah, so this is a very first step. that we have put forth in this direction. Now, what our next step should be to like compute these indexes on a sample or a subpopulation basic level. And when we actually identify the markers, they can be actually utilized for both to measure the efficacies of interventions. Like we have actually tested this in the paper, we have come up with something called as the HAC-17-4. Like we take the rank awareness of the top 17 HAC taxa and we're shown that it performs equally well across multiple other indices like the dysbiosis index, the gut microbiome wellness index, what all these. So it performs equally well. And at the same time, unlike these indices, because these are based on global conservation or patterns of global consistency, they don't show stark variations across different populations. So one of the things will be to utilize this index as a diagnostic tools, like how suppose here what we have done is we did a prospective analysis. So in India, we have a collaboration with some of my collaborators. They work on fecal microbiome transplantation. One of my collaborators, Vinita Ahuja, he was also involved, and he was also part of this HAC study. And we tested it out on some of the cohorts. And what we observed is that generally the donor microbiome, so they do FMT trials, and we tested the microbiome. So the best, some of the best. So this is, again, this is some ongoing work. So microbiomes, donor microbiomes, they tend to have the higher HAC of 17 scores. Generally, that we observed are the ones that tend to have a better response during trials. At the same time, what we also observed is, so there were other dietary studies like partial enteric nutrition. And there also we have observed the same that people who responded to the nutrition, they had a significant increase of their HAC top 17 foods. So in the HAC paper, we have shown it only was distinguished between disease and controls. Now we are observing the same thing for the same patterns. It also, we are saying that it has a utility when you are looking into the efficacies of some of these interventions also. We have not tried all. We are actually investigating that. But I think that this can be used as a measure for both. But we have to do more tests and more analysis to actually check them. Like how stable are these across different kinds of interventions? Because the currently whatever interventions that we have looked at are mostly IBD or like UC or ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. We have to look at it from different kind of diseases to see if this can be universal. But I definitely think what we're trying to do here is, like you very well pointed out, that microbiome is very complex right now. And the problem that we have is unless you come up with certain common markers or certain common endpoints that we should look at, still then it will be very complex. So we are to reach to that level, we should come up with this common candidate that can be then utilized at various levels. So we can come up with like PCR-based testing, like some of it, if it's stable, we can actually develop like non-sequencing-based diagnostics as well. That's what I feel, if things work out well, we can actually move in that direction.
So Tarini, let's kind of help the listeners understand the basic approach. So there might be four different individuals. There, two of them are healthy, two of them are not healthy. But even the two healthy people have very different microbiomes potentially. And the two very unhealthy people might have very different microbiomes. And you're trying to come up with a way to give each of those four people scores that describe how healthy or not they are. Can you talk to us about the three metrics that go into the HAC index? You mentioned them earlier, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about each of those three different metrics and why they're important.
Okay, Daniel. So the HAC index is made up of three different scores, like the three different matrices. The first matrix is called the core association matrix. So the core association matrix is basically based on the concept that if you remove a particular species from the microbiome, like if a abundance of a species is changing across the microbiome, how strong is the composition of the other taxa associated with it? So we developed a method called 3R method. So in that method, what we did was for every study cohort that we included some 127 study cohort, and out of that, 72 were the ones which contained only non-disease individuals. So what we did is, in each of the study cohort, we took a specific species, we removed it from the evidence from the compositional profile, and then we re-normalized the compositional profile. So the compositional profile is not aware of the abundance of these species. And then we looked into the beta diversity of the communities and correlated that with the abundance of these species. Now, if the species is connected to multiple other taxa, it is influenced by multiple other taxa, there's the beta diversity of the microbiome of the study cohort will be strongly correlated to that. So that was the association score. And the core means, so we selected those taxa which were like having association score in the top 30 percentile for that particular study cohort. And then the other sub marking that we had is we also sorted, okay, they should be associated with other taxa, but they should be also the top prevalent one. That's how the core comes in. So based on the prevalence and the and their association pattern with the other taxa, we again rank the species per study level. That gave us an index like which species tend to be more prevalent and tend to be more connected. So that gave us a ranking order based on their consistency. So that was the core association score.
Okay.
Now, similarly, we took the second index, that is the longitudinal stability index. So for longitudinal stability index, we had the longitudinal data sets. So and when we are longitudinal data sets, for a given data set, for sample, what we did was we computed something called as a follow-up distance. That is the distance between a particular individual's microgram at time point zero with time point one with respect to the microgram at time point zero. So, and our assumption was that people, the species that tend to be high at time point zero, if they are associated with lower follow-up distance to the subsequent time point, so they should be the ones that are associated with stability. So here also we did the same thing, that we removed the species, we renormalized the microbiome and composition profile, and then we did computed the distance between the follow-up time point and the current time point. And then we did a meta-analysis to see that is the evidence correlated negatively like with this distance. And then we measured species showing significantly negative association with this follow-up distance across multiple cohorts, and we did the same rank using a meta-analysis approach. So this was the longitudinal association. The third association was very simple. So we had, again, close to 36,000 microbiomes from studies that were paired disease control, like disease and paired control studies. And they covered 28 different disease conditions. And that was more or less, again, what we did was across the studies, we identified the taxa that are depleted or increased in these diseases. And we counted how frequently was the taxa associated with the non-disease population across these 28 diseases. So that gave us a third index. And the combining this index was basically very simple. We took the mean of these scores and then multiplied that with a penalty score, like it's a reward score, that is one minus the Gini of this score. Like if they are very similar scores, then you get a one, or if they are very variable scores, even though the mean is high, but the scores are variable, your score gets better down. So based on that, we came up with the half score, that is the mean of these three scores, into the one minus Gini of the three scores that we worked with here.
And that's really, I mean, extraordinary work. And I really would encourage people to look at the paper, which is going to be, there'll be a link in the podcast to this paper. It was only just published. Tree, I feel like we go on forever. Your enthusiasm and your energy is just infectious. But we're going to have to bring it to a close now. So thank you so much for sharing your ideas, and particularly the Hack Index, which I think has tremendous promise for our field. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Tarini. I really like the clever way you use functional data to get it and base everything on composition, but really screen composition to make sure it's relevant to health.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.